From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Spring equinox occurred last week, and that means two things. Spring is just 1 month away, and Brian McInerney stops by the studio. He'll join us to give us his usual update on all things weather, water, and climate.
Then, next up, we'll be speaking with Professor Terry Mesmer from Utah State University and graduate student Brandon Flack regarding sage-grouse. This has been a hot topic in Utah due to the question of whether or not to list this species as an endangered species. We'll talk about their biology, Brandon's research, and how the information he's gathering will be used to help shape policy in Utah.
Great. And after that, we'll speak with Seth Buchholz. He is a founder and owner of Buchholz Landscape Architecture. We'll talk about some of the commercial and private landscaping Seth and his team have designed and installed, and what clients are asking more of these days when it comes to landscape architecture.
That's right. And then if we have time, we'll cover a few news highlights from this week, including some interesting new almond trees that are being developed.
Bee free.
Pollinator
literally,
free.
Literally, bee free. That's a good thing, I think.
Question mark there.
And maybe an update on last night's event at Swanner.
That's right. And the solar panel meeting as well. There's lots to talk about.
All right. Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW, This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
KPCW and the Project for a Deeper Understanding present the Public Lands Initiative, Is It Right for Us? Join panelists from congressional offices and public land interest groups Tuesday, April 5th at St. Luke's Church at 7 p.m. Join this critical forum in person or on KPCW. It's a vital look into the future of Utah's wildlands, April 5th. KPCW's live broadcast is sponsored by the Summit Land Conservancy.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability, environmental stewardship, our relationships and impacts upon the environment.
How long can you keep going, Chris?
I don't know. We have an hour-long show to fill.
50 more minutes.
But we have lots of guests and lots of topics to talk about. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
That's right. And joining us in the studio, as usual, on a quarterly basis, whether we like it or not, he just shows
whether
up.
Whether he likes it or not. Well,
okay, that's right. That was the way to say it. Brian McInerney, he is a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City. And he's here to give us his usual seasonal update, among other things, about how our winter had kind of unfolded. Last time you were here, Brian, was December.
Yeah.
The solstice.
Yeah.
And we were just getting into that, and we were looking forward to what impacts the record-breaking El Nino would have on our winter precipitation. So, well, let's get to that, because that's probably going to kind of serve as the foundation to, you know, many of our other questions. So,
So
we know we had a record-breaking El Nino out there in the western or mid-Pacific. Right, as a general location?
120 degrees west, 170 degrees west, right in that area. Degrees north, 5 degrees south.
That's what I thought.
Right in that area.
We need to break out a map here.
That area.
South of Hawaii.
There you go. Okay. South of Hawaii.
Yeah.
And it influences our weather patterns, weather conditions.
Yeah.
And what was the thought was that this was going to have what kind of effect on our weather in the winter?
So when you look at an El Nino, there's different kinds. When you have strong El Ninos, and we were looking at a record-breaking El Nino, and for those
record-breaking in terms of temperature, water temperatures,
yeah,
when extent and the warmth of the water, right?
Yeah, and really we use this term all the time, and when you think of really what's going on is down near the equator in this area, the wind blows from east to west, the trade winds, and they blow frequently on a regular basis. But what happens occasionally is they quit or they slow down. And when that does, the warm ocean waters spread from west back to east toward Ecuador. And when it does that, now you've got this area that's massive that puts out all sorts of heat, energy, moisture, and thunderstorms on a giant scale. Mm-hmm. And that basically changes the jet stream because you're now adding this energy input to the atmosphere. Well, this was a record breaker. And we're going to see more of these as the oceans continue to warm. They mm-hmm. actually had to raise the average for El Nino. Because the oceans are so warm, we were always in an El Nino. So they had to bump that up. Now we're at a record-setting El Nino. So we expected something different. And what you expect with a very strong El Nino is that what's called the subtropical jet stream, meaning the southerly jet, the Pineapple Express, if you will, that area becomes much more dominant. The storms out of the Pacific Northwest become weaker, and you don't really see them that much. That's the theory.
Okay.
So the desert southwest is supposed to get a lot more precip and a lot cooler temperatures. The Pacific Northwest gets warmer and drier. Northern Utah is right in the middle of that, so mm-hmm. the correlation isn't the greatest. Like if you see a scatter plot of Alta snow during El Niños, it's kind of just a circular pattern. There's really no good correlation. But southern Utah does much better. And really what we were looking at the National Weather Service is we've been dominated by that high pressure for the past 4 years. It sets up in October and it stays through the spring, and then it comes around during the cold season. So we were hoping for a change, and a change is what we got. It was really nice. We had a really active pattern in November, and when we talked in December, we were just starting to get a lot of snow, a lot of storminess. It was colder than normal. And then we moved into January, and that same pattern kept. And the skiing was wonderful. It was good powder, good skiing, continuously cool temperatures, and a very active, progressive storm pattern. And by the end of January, we thought, boy, this is looking really good. And we mm-hmm. were kind of wondering if we were going to get to about 140 to 150% of normal snowpack.
Wow.
Because if we could have done that, most likely we could have had an average runoff, because this year's snowpack is sitting on a very dry sponge from the prior 4 years. Dry soils, low groundwater, and we're going to lose some of the melt into the soils and into the groundwater this spring. But unfortunately, February hit and the dreaded high pressure returned. And it's
the dreaded high pressure.
What happened?
It was the high pressure didn't really go away. It just oscillated out right. over the Pacific, and it was much smaller. So the door was open for all these different storms to come through. And we never really did get the good subtropical jet that we expected. Storms were coming at us from all over the place, from the Pacific Northwest in November, and they track farther down the coast than we would expect it because the ocean waters were so warm. They fed off of that. And then the lows would rotate in south of Utah. So we didn't really get it in November, but then we got it in December, January. And then that ridge that was out over the Pacific moved inland. And when that happens, it acts to block any dynamics or weather from the Pacific. All the storms that were coming that would have hit us hit the high pressure, went up over the top, mm-hmm. and put more storms up into Canada and then down. And this was the pattern we had for the last 4 or 5 years. Granted, that pattern we had for those four years was massive. It went up to Alaska, down to the equator,
right?
And it was a big blocking force. This was much smaller, but what it did was it shunted all the storms away from us, and we didn't see the benefits.
So instead of that 140% thought mm-hmm. in January,
yeah.
February occurs, and then so where were we at the end of February?
We were down to about 85%.
Wow,
we were ahead of the game. And then another thing that occurs is that we melt the snow from 6,000 to about 8,500 feet. And right. anybody who's a skate skier in town knows that the conditions were great.
Right.
And then within about 10 days, it went away. It just melted off because we had an excessive amount of solar radiation. We had temperatures that were much warmer than normal. And we didn't get any snow to augment it. And so the snow melted away on the skate ski tracks. And that's what you notice when you think, this is where I live, this is what I do. And the skate skiing went away, just like that. I think the golf course is still open. And then what happened is about the second week of March, the high broke down and we got progressive again. And now we're seeing the benefits of our second really good storm in about 7 days. and we anticipate a small amount of ridging and then some more storms coming. So this is a really well-timed event and a really well-timed change in the pattern that we had, you know, 17 inches or 15 inches on the hill from the storm last night. Mm-hmm. I think the canyon's got 17 inches. And we expect more today through Wednesday. And then we're going to go back to a little high-pressure ridging with warmer temperatures. And then we're going to see if the next system will affect us. But if we can have a cold, wet period through April, this will be very beneficial for the skiing and for our water supply.
Okay.
It's a win-win.
Yeah.
So do you think this will get us kind of back up over that 100%?
Yeah, I do. I think we were at 95% yesterday before this storm overall. When you average down the mountains down on the front side near Salt Lake City, they were about 95. We're about 95 at the upper Weber Basin. And then if you look at just one isolated point, and typically you don't want to do that because it kind of cherry picks the data. Mm-hmm. But Trial Lake is a good indicator of the headwaters for the Bear, the Weber, the Provo, and the Duchesne. It's on Mira Lake Highway. And that's the highest point, and everything kind of breaks off from there. They were at 99% yesterday. They're going to be up at average today. If we can keep this going, it's great.
So what does this mean then for our water storage in the coming season? You know, we've been definitely looking at some lowish reservoir levels over the past couple of years.
Yeah, the reservoirs are not doing very well, but if you really look at the conditions that influence the reservoirs, the water districts and the water managers have done a really good job keeping as much water as possible in the reservoirs. We're expecting right now with what we have about 65% to 70% runoff volume going into the reservoirs this year, and that's mainly due to the dry soils and the low groundwater. We have normal snowpack, but we're going to lose it. A good chunk of that due to losses into the soils. Then we're going to put that in the reservoirs, which are already low. Mm-hmm. Then at that point, they have to decide if they have enough water in the reservoirs to allocate and all the water to the people that have rights, the farmers for the most part. Are they going to get total allocations? The last 4 years, they've had 50% allocations. The farmers have been shorted because we are so short. And then we had some really good July, August, and September rain events for the mm-hmm. past 3 years. So people didn't use the stored water. They used the rainwater. Mm-hmm. So these things combined to have our reservoir levels, they're not going to fill this year most likely, but they're going to get improved amounts compared to the last 4 years.
Who's making the decision on the allocation?
It's the Utah water law. They have certain levels that when they hit those levels, low levels, then you get certain allocations. And it's incredibly complicated.
Right.
If you're an engineer who gets a job at the Provo River Water Users, the guy told me it takes about 6 years before you fully understand how the system works. And he tried to explain it to me in 10 minutes, and my head was spinning. You know, it was incredibly complicated.
It was a bit
complicated.
Too compressed for
Yeah, right.
You see presentations on these things at water-related conferences, and it is just outrageously complex.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Really?
You can sit there and listen for 2 hours and leave the room and think, what just happened?
Yeah, like Jordanelle.
Do they understand it? You
yeah.
wonder if they actually understand.
They get it. The guys that have been there the mm-hmm. longest get it. But if you talk to them, like Jordanelle, you think it's just water. Well, that's not true. There's certain Jordan Valley water. Then there's Provo River water users. Mm-hmm. And then if they decide to, the people from the Weber decide to move water over. By the time you're done, it's really hard to understand, but they have a handle on it. Central Utah Project, they move this water around through pipes all over the place. And we don't really see it, but it comes out of the tap on a regular basis. It's clean. It's plentiful. We have it, and it works really well.
And it's like I said, it's a system with a lot of moving parts, and it's going to have even more parts as we continue to grow. Population,
yeah.
Economically, you know, et cetera. The demand isn't going to go down.
Mm.
Another interesting point on water rights and water use is that the streams themselves don't have water rights. In most cases, there isn't a requirement for in-stream flow. So, for example, here in our basin, the streams can dry up, and that's perfectly legal if everybody is using their legal water rights.
So the fish have no rights.
Mm-hmm.
They have no right to water.
Right. It's not considered a
And we've actually
use.
Seen that some years mm-hmm. back on East Canyon. It dried up. It dries stopped up. Flowing.
The fish lose.
Yeah. And granted, people noticed it and said, we got to do something.
The ecosystem lose. I shouldn't say just the fish. The whole ecosystem loses.
Absolutely.
But they reallocated water back into the creek and got it going again. But it was one of those moments that, like, holy cow, East Canyon has kind of dried up, and it's not a good thing. We need to...
And that's one of those things we've kind of seen the past couple of years. There's been concern because it's been so dry. We've had drier winters. But those rains that you mentioned that we've been getting toward the end of the summer, mm-hmm. I think, have kind of saved the day. What weather patterns been generating those rains?
So when the general winter pattern goes away, we have storms coming out of the Pacific Northwest, big low pressures that move out from the west, from the southwest. All our weather, for the most part, comes from the west. Then when you go into the summer season, it changes. It becomes more localized. And then Mexico starts heating up. The orientation of the Mexican area is almost 90 degrees to the sun as we move into July. And as a result, that area becomes much warmer than its surrounding area. It creates a low pressure. It pulls in moisture from the Pacific off of the Gulf of California on the Pacific side, and that moisture gets pulled up into Mexico, and then it moves farther up into Arizona and southern Utah. And they call that monsoonal moisture, and it's really not a monsoon like you see in India, but mm-hmm. it's a term that's cyclical.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah. And so monsoonal. Some years you don't get much moisture at all, but some years you get a lot depending on how that pattern is moving. And the monsoonal moisture during July, August, and September has produced widespread thunderstorms of great intensity over a long period of time. And when you have it move all the way up to northern Utah, then we all benefit from those rains during those time frames. Unfortunately, it brings incredible flash floods, devastating flash floods down in southern Utah. And that's something we warn for on a regular basis. Last year, we had thunderstorms that moved from Arizona into the polygamous town of Hilldale and Zion National Park. And we had 21 people get killed, basically from one thunderstorm complex that moved through the area. And when you look at how intense they are, we're seeing more of these intense thunderstorms frequently on a regular basis. And trying to warn for these things is becoming more difficult because our radars are located at 10,000 feet down in southern Utah. Because if we have them lower, the beam runs into the mountains, so mm-hmm. we have to put them on top. So by the time it goes over Capitol Reef National Park, it's at about 22,000 feet. Anything below that, we really don't see. So it could be a very wet air mass or it could be very dry. And there's an unknown. It's a variable we can't quantify, which makes it more difficult.
That's really interesting about the radar. I guess I've never quite understood how that works. So how is that placement decided?
So... Back when they started doling out radars, the federal government said, we need weather radars. Because when I first started this job in 1990, we used to use satellite to warn for flash floods, which is ridiculous. It's such a bad tool for what we're trying to do, but it's the best we had. And then we put radars all throughout the U.S. And our ability to warn for these storms, tornadoes, floods, has improved dramatically. But for the west, you have mountains. If you put it low, the beam is just going to hit the mountain and stop, and you won't see anything beyond that. So you have to get higher than the mountains. So that means you got to get it on the highest mountain, which is at Cedar Breaks, east of Cedar City, and then the radar works really well. But you miss a good chunk of area that's below the radar beam at the lowest angle. And it goes out at half a degree elevation. So it rises as it goes away. So like Capitol Reef is about 22,000 mm-hmm. feet. And we still do a good job because we have the weather balloon is launched that morning at 4 o'clock in the morning. It samples the atmosphere from the surface up to 100,000 feet. So we know if it's really moist below 22,000 feet in Capitol Reef, we're going to get more rain. We have an idea of that. If it's really dry, we're going to get a lot of wind. And so we factor this in. We factor in where these storms are having rain, and then we factor in what kind of ground it is. Is it have vegetation? Is it steep slope? And then we issue warnings for this kind of stuff. So it's kind of complex, and it's not an exact science for sure, but we're doing much better with this.
We've got a couple more minutes. I only have like six more questions. Okay. So... But the most important one probably is the El Nino is dissipating, as we might. Well, I guess that's one term you might use. It's kind of gradually shrinking.
Yeah.
Turning into what? La Nina? What's happening next?
They expect it to go to neutral conditions, which
neutral means
what you would expect to be in that area on average if you were to quantify it, which means then our ability to forecast beyond 7 days goes away. We really don't have any good way to forecast weather beyond 7 days once that strong El Nino went away.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the
and that's happening now, or it'll be considered to go at normal in about what time? April, May, or
probably about June is when we'll get
slowly
back. But they still anticipate the effects of El Nino will continue, which hasn't been what you would expect. But nonetheless, we're getting snow.
Okay. Any other questions?
I think it's time to start wrapping up, Brian.
Okay.
Well, this is really fascinating, and I think what's interesting is that in addition to what we talked, of course, we heard on NPR, sea ice extent is at its its minimum max.
Yeah.
We're seeing record coral bleaching episodes going around.
Warmest February globally we've ever
warmest
had.
February globally.
Warmest.
So Brian, what has to happen
winter
in order to convince you that the planet is warming? What are you waiting for, Brian?
It's convinced me. It's warming, and it's getting warmer all the time.
And it's getting warmer all the time, and you're seeing evidence of it here year over year or decade over decade.
Yeah.
As temperature trends.
Yeah, we're seeing more rain during the meteorological winter than we have before, and that's going to continue until rain is what we get during the wintertime by about when you look at about 2035, areas that are 90 to 100% snow covered will be about 50% snow covered. And then that's going to continue.
So it won't be like you guys are joking about, it won't be packed powder so much. It'll be as wet powder.
It'll be kind of grassy
it'll
looking.
Be what, grassy powder?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. And of course, pitch your website.
Weather.gov?
You bet. That's the place to go.
Oh, it's awesome.
To follow the trends, get information, learn the science behind weather and warming and these events that are occurring. That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
We'll see you in the summer.
That's right. Next time we talk, it'll be June, and we'll get an update on, I'm sure, the latest extremes. So Brian McInerney with the National Weather Service, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
All right, let's take a break for a couple of underwriters. When we come back, we're going to talk sage grouse, right?
That's right. We'll be speaking with Terry Mesmer and Brandon Flack about sage grouse biology and policy here in Utah.
Stay with us. It's This Green Earth.
The Vail Resort's Epic Promise Foundation is a proud supporter of KPCW, and it can now support Vail Resort's employees with emergency relief grants. Information about these emergency grants for employees can be found at epicpromise.com.
I'm Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage services, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Summit County residents are on track to recycle more than 8 million pounds in 2016. All-in-one recycling is as easy as tossing your paper, cardboard, and empty plastic products in your designated recycling bin. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that is Chris Cherniak.
That's right.
Across the board. And on the phone with us for this second segment of the show today is Professor Terry Mesmer with USU and graduate student Brandon Flack, and we'll be talking about sage grouse. This has been a hot topic in Utah because of the question of whether or not to list this bird as an endangered species. And so now we're going to talk about the biology, Brandon's research, and how they'll use that information in order to help shape policy here in Utah. So Terry and Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thanks for having us.
So let's start by talking a little bit about your background on sage grouse. How long have you been working on this topic?
Well, I started really looking into the sage-grouse problem, so to speak, way back in 1990s. The first local working groups and the first research that we really started to kind of try to map the species ecology in the state was about 1997. And then since then, it's been close to 20 years, we've pretty much mapped the ecology for most of the population. And Brandon's work in the Morgan Summit, Rich Morgan Summit area, is providing a piece of that puzzle that we still don't know much about.
So give us the basics on this bird. What are they? Where do they live? What are the challenges they're facing?
Well, the bird is it lives pretty much throughout the western western North American landscape, sagebrush landscape, and so there are strong pockets of good populations, and there are areas where the bird's been extirpated because of the loss of that that sagebrush landscape in Utah. Based on the research that we've done, we've identified 11 areas which are basically the best opportunity to manage for the long-term conservation of the species. And in the state, that translates to roughly about 7.5 million acres, which is estimated to maybe be about 40-50% of what was there historically. And again, we really don't know what those numbers were. We're just basically estimating that based on changes in sagebrush canopy. And so with the research, we've identified areas that incorporate about 95% of the known population and offer the best opportunity for managing the species. Now, in each of the areas, the threats are somewhat different. You know, if you go to the west, we've got areas where we've got wildfires, and then if we look at other areas to the east, you know, we've got potential for oil and gas, and then mixed throughout, we've got the possibility of some residential development and some other different things. And so the threats really aren't the same in all locations, but there are some general patterns, and one of those is habitat fragmentation. It's the threat of wildfires, and with that, invasive species and what that could do to deteriorate habitat in the future.
So before we get too deep into the science and policy, give us a profile of the bird. What does it look like? How long do they live? What do they eat? That kind of thing.
Okay, I'll turn that over to Brandon. That's up his alley.
Yeah, so they're a ground-dwelling, ground-nesting bird. They're roughly the size of a chicken. The females weigh 2 to 3 pounds, and the males can weigh up to 6 pounds. They're relatively long-lived in the wild, meaning that they can live up to 5 or 6 years in the wild. As Terry said, they're what we call a sagebrush obligate, which means that not only do they like sagebrush, but they require it for survival, especially in the wintertime. 99% of their diet is made up of sagebrush, and so they require good, healthy sagebrush landscapes in order to survive. They're a lekking species, which means that they congregate on one central location to mate, and they do that one time per year. That time period usually lasts from late February into mid-May, but the heaviest times are in April, usually. That's when the females usually attend at the highest rates. And so, those are really important components to, the survival of the species.
What is the relationship of sage grouse to the greater ecosystems? Basically, if you don't have sage grouse, I think Terry mentioned that some areas have been extirpated, which means they're no longer there, right? They've been kind of pushed out or pushed away, or their habitat is no longer available to them. So what happens to the ecosystems in their absence? Do they change dramatically?
Yeah, the sagebrush landscape is, it's a landscape that's the dominant land cover throughout the West. And so as populations grow, as land uses changes, we see sagebrush disappear from the landscape. And so
the critical factor of all the research we've done. I mean, we have differences in terms of grass and forbs and all of that stuff within these landscapes. But basically, the one dominant factor, as Brandon pointed out, is the sagebrush canopy cover. Is we need that cover, and as we lose that cover, what we do is we impact the suitability of the habitat. We have annual variations. Our populations in Utah are cyclic. Depending on when you look at the numbers, there are about 9 to 12 years where we've got highs or lows. And so the goal of the Utah plan and our work is to find out what we can do to manage so that those population peaks tend to be higher and then also those troughs tend to be also higher. And we can do that hopefully by managing these conservation threats.
Brandon, do you want to talk a little bit about the specifics of your research, what it is your goal to learn with your research?
Yeah, sure. So as Terry mentioned, this population here in Morgan and Summit counties, there's very little known about it. The information that we have had in the past is just information that helps us track population trends. So every year, people go out and will count the number of males that they see on a lek, on a mating ground. And with that information, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources can calculate and get an idea of the population size in that area. So up until this point, that's all the information that we've had on this population. And so we're looking at several different things. We're looking at migration patterns. You know, we want to know, where do these birds spend the summer? Where do they spend those critical times of nesting and brood rearing? And then once their chicks are raised and kind of can get off on their own, do they transition to another area for the fall? And then do they transition to a different area for winter? And so we're looking at those different habitat use areas and looking to see if there are migration corridors that connect those. And then we want to look at the survival rates for each of those different time periods. What's the nest success rate? What's the brood success rate? How many chicks are they raising to be juveniles and yearlings? What's the seasonal survival? How many of them live through the winter time? That sort of thing. And then as a part of that, we look at vegetation structure. So we measure at each of those nest locations and each of those brood sites where we locate a hen that has chicks. We measure the vegetation in those areas, which gives us an idea of, you know, maybe why that hen chose that location. And, we're also kind of looking at habitat fragmentation. This is an area that has a lot of private land. It's mostly private land. Some of the habitat has been converted to agriculture. Some of it's just not suitable because it's got too much oak brush, or it's higher elevation forest habitat, which sage grouse don't like. And so, trying to look at those things is pretty important. So those are kind of the main goals that we're trying to figure out.
Chris in the studio here is saying, these are picky birds. But so your research is focused right here in Summit and Morgan counties. Can they handle the kinds of like cold temps, high altitudes, things like that we see here?
Do they have the ability to adapt? Do they have resiliency?
Absolutely, yeah. It seems like that they're limited, but the limiting factor, again, is sagebrush. So if they have sagebrush that they can access, then they can survive. And we've found in other studies throughout the state that, you know, as Terry mentioned, the percentage of forb or grass cover in a specific area can be lower or higher, and the birds still do well, you know. And as far as elevation, as long as they're sagebrush, they're good. So I study over here. I'm over by East Canyon Reservoir. You know, I've actually seen birds in the summertime when it's hot. I've seen them use the oak brush as shade, you know, to stay cool. So they don't love it. They don't use it all the time. They need the sagebrush. They need it for nesting. They need it for protection. They need it for food. But they will dip into these other habitat types, when it's convenient for them or when they see that they can use it. to their benefit. But it's not, you know, it's like I say, it's something that they just dip into. It wouldn't be something that they could rely on.
So with all of this information that you are gathering and that, you know, Terry, you and your crew have gathered over the past 20 years, what's the goal with that information? How will that impact policy here in the state of Utah?
The data information we've collected over the last 20 years has basically been adapted and used in the Conservation Plan for Greater Sage-Grouse in Utah. That was published in February 2013.
I might just interject for a minute there. When you get a minute, talk a little bit about that plan. It was a long time in the coming.
Right. The plan, the Division of Wildlife Resources had through time, and I mentioned about the local working groups. All the local working groups, we started working with those groups in the 1990s, and so these local groups developed a local plan, a local conservation strategy for the areas. And so they had already been progressively doing some of this work well before we had any of these petitions to file that were filed to list the species. The Division of Wildlife Resources incorporated that into a statewide strategy in 2002, and that was amended in 2009. But all the local working groups had already developed their little plans and their strategies, and they were actually proceeding to implement some of the conservation actions at that time. And so in 2012, when the governor organized the task force to pull together an overall conservation strategy for the state, we had a lot of information already available that was rolled up and finalized into that final plan under the Public Lands Policy Coordination Office. And so what it basically at that time, it gave statewide endorsement and the governor's office endorsement saying that this is going to be Utah's conservation strategy. The focus of that strategy is not just on the LEX, but as Brandon pointed out, it's on all of those seasonal habitats. And so rather than just put a buffer around the LEX, if we did that, we would exclude some really, really important winter habitat or other seasonal habitat. And so the state plan is designed to be inclusive of all those seasonal habitats and manage it based on what the birds use and how we can manage that. Then in 2015, the governor signed an executive order, February 2015, which basically said that all state agencies and all the cabinet office under his purview will work together to implement this plan, and that there will be increased communication. And so what it did, it provided, if you will, the ribbon around efforts that have been conducted for 20 years that had been voluntary. And again, they're still voluntary, but it added a new emphasis in that it became the official policy of the state of Utah. Hmm.
So we have to start to wrap up here, but if people are interested in learning more about this, where can they go?
Well, we have a website that is available. If they Google Utah community-based conservation, they'll get the history of all of these local working groups. They'll get the research. They'll get the science. There's actually some pretty cool videos. And then in the next couple of days, we're going to be at the Swanner Center to talk about sage-grouse conservation, and Brandon will be there to talk specifically about his research, and that'll be on Thursday night there at the Swanner Center just outside of Park City.
And I happen to also know that on Friday morning at 5 a.m., there will be a LEC visit to watch these birds in action as well.
The birds are coming to Swanner?
Yeah. No, Swanner will be going to the birds.
Oh, I see.
Brandon and Terry will be guiding us through the experience.
At 5 a.m.?
That's when we're meeting.
Yeah, okay. They start early.
All right.
So to participate in that, you can register on our website to learn more from Professor Terry Mesmer and graduate student Brandon Flack about sage-grouse.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We'll hopefully
see you
Thursday night.
Thank you. That's right. See you soon.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll have one of our underwriters, Seth Bockholt from Bockholt Landscape Architecture on It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Lund, a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that Recycle Utah offers a commercial paper shredder? Located behind the mixed paper bin, anyone is welcome to use it. Shredded white paper can be turned into 100% recycled content paper again.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. We support KPCW and the idea of leading sustainable lives in Park City.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the studio is Seth Bockel. He is the founder and owner of Bockel Landscape Architecture, I assume. Is that correct?
That's right,
given
Chris.
The name?
Thank you. It's
a lucky guest.
Here.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll want to talk about just basically where some of the trends are in landscape architecture, where things are headed, how things are changing over time. But first, let's get a little background on you. This is your first visit to the show.
Yeah.
Why did you get into landscape architecture? How did you do that?
I got into landscape architecture really because of a girl I was dating in high school. Her father was a landscape contractor, and I started there. So I stayed in that industry, and I put myself through school as a contractor, and I love what I do.
Did you go to school to study landscape architecture?
Yeah, I guess that's one of the things I'd like your listeners to kind of take home from this conversation would be that there is a difference between a landscape architect and a landscape contractor. Although if you're to look at me, there's probably some similarities.
Sure.
I have a beard. I wear boots. But no, the landscape architecture is a regulated profession nationally. Mm-hmm. You are required to have a bachelor's degree from an accredited university, mm-hmm. pass tests, have a certain amount of experience
right.
to gain licensure.
So when did you found this company, Bockel Landscape Architecture?
Yeah, so I contracted as a landscape contractor for about 12 years. I started Bockel Landscape Architecture in 2012 here in Park City, and we've grown rapidly. I started out at 614 Main, same building with John DeGray, the architect there, and just started doing projects with him and other architects around town. And I've grown from just being the lone ranger landscape architect to now a firm with about five or six multidisciplinary professionals. We have a civil engineer, a land planner, mm-hmm. we do some grant acquisition, and we just kind of work as part of a team on construction projects, collaborating to try to find the best solutions for our clients.
So you're involved ideally up front in the planning process, the early design of a commercial building or a private home. To help understand what the client's looking for.
That's
not
right.
in terms of what, not only in terms of what the building is, but how the landscape might work within the building's confines
right.
and parameters, right?
That's right, Chris. I think if I was going to say what my design philosophy is, it would have to be to look for opportunities within the program for a project to find intentional ways to kind of playfully engage with the duality between the built and natural environments.
Mm.
And that contrast and agreement is interesting, and it's like meaningful on multiple levels, you know.
Well, give us an example of a couple of projects you've worked on around here. If people want to go out and see your work.
Right. We're working with several different homeowner associations right now doing kind of high level assessments of their grounds and landscapes and looking for ways to make it more sustainable and efficient, reduce costs, reduce water use.
Reduce grass?
Reduce, that's a big part of
Thank
that.
You.
Reduce the costs and the water use. That,
right.
You know,
and
so
the chemical use
demanding.
And the fuel use that
yeah.
goes with growing
exactly.
Non-native Kentucky bluegrass. Right,
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. We are working, one of the most interesting projects we have right now is the Echo Spur development with Preston Campbell and Sean Kelleher.
Right.
And there's a big kind of sustainable push with the site and landscape on those homes where we have green roofs, rainwater harvesting systems, you know, native plantings, really efficient
subsurface irrigation and things like that. Building a sustainable home in interior-wise, the structure, but also outdoors.
It's got to overlap.
Landscape. Yes. And so you're working with that. Okay. Uh-huh.
So what drives your focus on sustainability? It seems like a lot of your projects kind of have this focus on doing the right thing environmentally.
I'm from this area, and we see so much change and growth. I think we have a responsibility to make sure that that growth is guided in a smart, sustainable way so that we can maintain our lifestyle and the beauty all around us, you know?
And not abuse or exploit resources,
absolutely,
natural resources in one way, and water is a critical resource.
Definitely is.
Okay. So what are the trends you might be seeing? How long you've been in the business for a number of years, are you seeing attitudes changing with respect to client demands, whether, again, on a commercial level or private home level?
Definitely. One of the great things about being a landscape architect in Utah is you just have to look east and or across the pond to see what the trends coming are. Park City is very progressive with terms of building trends compared to the rest of the West, but we see, you know, more demand for green roofs, community gardens, rainwater harvesting systems, bioswales, just different ways to treat stormwater management, permeable paving, things like that to increase the or decrease the level of impermeable surfaces and on a project.
So again, a lot of water-related conservation, preservation,
it all comes down management to water
practices.
And dirt.
Are there any challenges with respect to some ordinances or regulations that can kind of at times put barriers or limits on some of the things you want to do?
It's more like a challenge because of the lack of ordinances and jurisdictional authorities erring on the side of caution because they have not researched or adopted new green ordinances with terms of, you know, how a site is developed with green roofs or alternatives to stormwater management rather than just putting everything into a pipe, allowing it to stay on site and treat it in different ways like that.
But you see these kinds of ordinances coming online in other areas, other states maybe?
Absolutely.
So there are model ordinances out there that this area could look at.
There are a load of
consider.
Case studies back east and even in Europe that ordinances are in place and their success. I mean, I think the city of Toronto has a goal to actually have 25% of the roof coverage be green roof, you know, within the next 10 years. In areas in France and Germany, green roofs are required for commercial building as part of the system.
But, of course, this is a high desert environment, so a green roof here is going to look dramatically different from a green roof back east.
Yeah, there are some exceptions.
Okay.
That you have to
But it can still work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So how do you stay kind of up to date on the latest in this area? Is there a membership organization, a certification?
Yeah, there are. And I kind of wanted to talk a little bit, too, about the United States Green Building Council.
Right.
And the Sustainable Sites Initiative. Recently, I guess let me do a little bit of background. The Sustainable Sites Initiative was developed in like 2006 by the American Society of Landscape Architects and the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Texas. And it's an equivalent scoring and rating system for like LEED buildings for sites and landscapes. Last year, the USGBC just acquired the program, and they are rolling out new certifications in line with the LEED goals, and they call it sites. And so there's a lot of talk within my profession that that could be a game changer for
really?
New developments. Yeah.
Okay.
So if somebody's interested in pursuing this, what do they need to do? What do they need to be thinking about on their site?
Well, they should have a landscape architect involved early in the process to kind of educate them, their program, and architect, engineers, other professionals working on the project on how that could benefit their program.
Okay. All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but you're going to be back, and we're going to talk more about the work you do and some of the projects, because what you're doing is critical to creating, again, an environment here, a landscaped environment that is more in tune with the natural surroundings.
Thank you.
And that's critical. And it's even critical from this town trying to get to net zero because of all the energy used that's required to move water around. And the less water and the more water conservation practices we involve ourselves with, the less energy we use. So it's all linked together. That's what we talk about on this show. Last word, website, people want to learn about me.
Bockholtlandscapearchitecture.com. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time, Chris.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Seth is a registered landscape architect, environmental planner, and founder and director of Bockholt Landscape Architecture. Thanks again for stopping by, Seth. Let's take one last break for a couple underwriters, and we'll be back.
That's right.
To wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew, Director of Skier Services for Park City and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City instructors bring a passion for teaching skiing and snowboarding that help guests build confidence, improve their skills, and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. We got a minute.
We left out
six stories we wanted to cover? We'll have to save it next week because we want to talk about what you did at last night at Swanners, meet the producers.
Yeah, fun night.
Do a little summary
on
the
Summit. We need the update on the Summit Community Solar. We have lots.
Stories, the bee-free almond trees. You got to join us next week. We promise we'll squeeze those in. But right now, we got to thank our underwriters.
That's
who make the show possible. They include
Recycle Utah.
Republic Services.
Bockholt Landscape Architects.
Thank you. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties.
San Francisco Design.
And Park City.
You can always join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
Or email us.
That's right.
At thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.
Only in Park City. I got this one now.
All right,
only
you got it.
On KPCW. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week. NPR News is next.